Welcome back to the CTO Playbook, the podcast dedicated to helping CTOs excel. In this episode, I'm speaking with Yorgos Christou, a professor of computer science, a seasoned consultant, and former CTO, about the fundamental mistakes founder engineers make when building startups. From choosing a tech stack based on familiarity to overlooking the business implications of technical decisions, Yorgos shares real stories and actionable advice to help you avoid costly pitfalls. If you're thinking about becoming the tech founder for a startup or a tech leader looking to make smarter choices to align your technical strategy with business goals, this episode is where it's at. I'm your host, Adam Horner. As a coach for new CTOs navigating their first few leadership roles, I empower tech leaders to break free from the daily grind of crisis management and build the skills to lead with confidence and purpose. Many CTOs I work with are former engineers who were promoted into leadership, but then overwhelmed with constant firefighting, unsure how to communicate effectively with non-technical executives, and uncertain about their strategic impact. Drawing on over 30 years of hands-on experience, I provide practical, personalized coaching tailored to these exact challenges, helping CTOs shift from reactive problem-solving to proactive strategic leadership. My coaching helps each CTO forge their own path for growth, allowing them to delegate confidently, align engineering with the business goals, and step into their roles as trusted, respected peers at the executive table. This podcast is my way of giving back to the communities of CTOs that have supported me over the years, and between me and my guests, we cover crucial topics for CTOs, providing insights, strategies, and practical advice to help you build and refine your playbook to excel as a CTO. Yorgos, welcome to the CTO Playbook. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm looking forward to this because the listeners have got a really interesting person to get to know here. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into being this sort of software evangelist.
So I started with computers when I was about 8 years old. It was IBM PC compatibles. And I eventually ended up going to Carnegie Mellon to study computer science. While there, I met a lot of wow people. Finished there and got into a master's and PhD track in at Tufts University. However, while doing that, a friend of mine asked me if we would like to open up a business together. So we opened up a startup, no concept of a startup back then, but that's pretty much what it was.
Two guys and an idea, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We started doing web development when in Cyprus, web development was unheard of. And we got through a few projects and he got sidetracked into his work. I got sidetracked into my PhD. So we closed down the company. A couple of years after that, I became the CTO for another startup that wanted to emulate Expedia.
Quite ambitious then.
Exactly, for Europe. And we were on track. We had venture capital. We had a lot of stuff, but we'll talk about how that went later on in the episode.
Excellent. Okay.
And after that, I remained in the industry as a consultant while I became a professor in academia. So I was basically one foot in both.
That's quite unusual.
Yeah, I know. But I never wanted to leave the industry because I believe that's where you hone your skills. And if you don't have enough experience from the trenches, then it's very difficult to convey the concepts that you need to convey as an academic. And I found that I could draw from all the consulting examples that I had to provide context to my students.
And that's quite a commitment to get to the professorship. It's quite an undertaking, isn't it? I mean, that must have taken years, right?
20 years, approximately.
Wow. Cool. Okay. And during all that time, you're consulting through those 20 years and clearly picked up a few good stories to retell during that time as well.
A lot of stories.
Cool. So just to bring us up to date then, what is it you're doing these days? Because you're actually based, and I can see the map behind you, you're actually based in Cyprus, right?
Yes. So these days I'm a freelance consultant and I also moonlight on LinkedIn, trying to get all that, you know, experience. Well, I don't want to say all that. I want to say that little bit of experience that I gained, I want to make it publicly available for hopefully helping people who come into the tech sector. And that's that's pretty much what I do.
And there's some great posts to follow on there for those of you who haven't done that so far. We'll have a link in the show notes towards the end.
Thank you so much.
Cool. So let's scoot back a little bit then, take you back to the beginning of those early days, that very promising story of how the Expedia competitor went there, because that sounded tantalizingly like a bit of a car crash that we'd love to hear about.
Oh, yes. So, and that will lead into one of the CTO playbook tactics that I'll suggest. What happened was I was extremely focused on building the product, because I knew that, you know, in that kind of environment that we were in, someone else would come up with the idea as well.
So it's a race against time, really.
Exactly. We had a very, very small window to go out there and be first in the sector in Europe. However, my non-technical founders superseded a lot of the decisions that I was bringing to the table. For example, while I was pushing towards finishing the product, they were pushing towards putting finishing touches on the website, making it look really nice, taking a long time making decisions on stuff like color, like button shapes, fonts, stuff that weren't really meaningful at the time, because now remember, we're talking about 25 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, did you have the experience to push back at that point? Did you realize then that it was probably the wrong priority? Or is that sort of the benefit of hindsight and being able to look back with rose-tinted glasses?
Unfortunately not. I knew that we were losing, we were burning through capital, first of all, and we were losing time. And I kept reiterating that. But I didn't have any concrete proof. You know, I didn't have any examples to say, hey, look at that company. They did that. They failed. Look at this company. They did that. They failed. So it was always, yeah, but we need to provide this beautiful experience and we need to provide this thing and all that jazz.
So you had a hunch that it was wrong, but not really enough data or comparables to point to go, look, those guys have got it wrong, and kind of prove it.
Exactly. And that was the frustrating part, because I knew I was right in the back of my mind, you know, but I also knew that the competition would probably catch up. So we burned through our capital, making a lot of other decisions that were not very sane, I will say. However, we did them, and eventually we didn't get the product fly at all.
And when you say at all, was it a complete flop, or were there aspects of it that worked?
Complete flop. We had the code, but we never published. We never put it online. We never put it in production.
Wow. And did you literally just run out of funds then?
Run out of funds and run out of time, because the competition started picking up. And we were, at that point, we didn't have any money for marketing. We didn't have any money to go out and get more venture capital. Because a lot of people don't realize this. You need money to get money.
Yeah, if you raise too late, you're kind of you're desperate, and VCs don't want to
exactly
contribute to desperate companies, do they? And I can imagine that at that point, then that must have been sort of quite a shocking disappointment to you. But when did you end up, I mean, clearly you've ended up with a bunch of takeaways from that, but what was sort of the most important lesson for you that you then took into your next ventures?
So two things: product velocity and making sure that you create a stream of income in the company as soon as possible. So those two were the two big ones.
Well, let's dig into the velocity a bit. Well, what do you mean? Because there's a lot of different ways in which velocity can be sort of talked about and used. So what do you mean when you say velocity?
When we say velocity, we mean a lot of things. You're absolutely right. Let me explain that in a layman's term, right? You start with a product, you finish the MVP, you put the MVP to beta testing, and that's where you start nitpicking. I apologize. But you already have a product out there. You already have claimed something in the marketplace. And as your product becomes better, the user experience becomes better, the reviews hopefully become better, and you also have that very valuable feedback from your users. And if you don't use that feedback, then I guarantee you're going to flop. But if you do use that feedback, even strategically, that's when you start gaining traction. That's when your product becomes a lot better, because you're listening to the people that are actually using your product. And eventually, you know, you have the opportunity to succeed.
Yeah. So this is the velocity that is otherwise termed as the flywheel effect, where you sort of got this positive feedback loop that's going, excellent, cool. I think it's a really great way of thinking about it. And so from there then, so what would you, like on this point of specifically having decisions that the non-technical founders are making, overriding, and what did you do better the next times around in your subsequent startups?
So I chose my co-founders better.
That's a very blunt way of putting it.
I know it sounds simple and I know it sounds raw, but in reality, when you're creating a business with someone else, you need to know that your ideas match, or your ideas match enough so that you can sit down on a table and say, you know what, this is what we're doing and this is how we're doing it. And you develop that plan that will cover all aspects of your understanding and their understanding of what you're trying to do. Otherwise, there are a lot of implications and other factors that you need to take into account. I've seen companies destroy themselves from the inside because there was an internal dispute between co-founders.
We see it all the time, don't we?
Exactly. And I've seen internal disputes lead to better products. So there's a lot to be said about internal disputes and about communication and how to handle communication. But in the end, it's good to get these things out in the open as early as possible.
And as a tech founder then, how do you go about choosing the non-technical founders you work with? What are sort of the criteria that you would make as your sort of non-negotiables going into that sort of relationship?
So first of all, you need somebody who's going to keep you honest.
Okay, so holding you to account.
Exactly. And another thing that I like to see is that when I talk about ideas and when they talk about ideas, we talk about them at the same level. And when I say we talk about them at the same level, in communication, there's people who like abstraction and then there's people who like detail. And this is a spectrum, right? So I'm usually at the abstraction side of the spectrum and I get really frustrated when I have to talk detail, unless I do have to talk about detail. So if a co-founder that I meet seems to fall towards the detail aspect of the spectrum, and I'm not criticizing that that's bad. If you're both on the detail aspect of the spectrum, then you match. But I wouldn't be able to get my ideas across in a way that the other person understands.
Right. So it's first of all stage is sort of know thyself, understand the way that you think about and communicate the ideas that you have, and then find somebody who's on that sort of same wavelength between abstract and sort of hyper detailed on the other end. Cool. So that's the first thing. Is there any other sort of key criteria to look for as well? Or is that one so overwhelming that it overrides most of the others?
So I don't want to talk about, you know, knowledge and complementary knowledge and all that stuff, because those are supposed to be there, right? When you're choosing co-founders.
So there's a very simple thing of don't choose another tech co-founder, basically.
I wouldn't go as far as saying that, because you have tech co-founders that understand the business perhaps better than you do. And you end up becoming, instead of a CTO, you become a CPO, chief product officer, right? And they become the chief technology officer. And then you go out and look for that business person, that marketing person, that salesperson. So there are a lot of things that can happen, that beginning stage.
So, but it is about that complementary balance, though, rather than it being overweighted to one side or any one direction, I should say, because it's not like it's linear.
Exactly. It should always be about that balance. Because if you don't have that complementary knowledge in the company, then you're always going to be missing something.
Yeah. Have you seen that go wrong in sort of interesting and relatable ways?
Interesting and relatable ways. Well,
in other words, an example you can actually talk about, because I've seen some examples that I'd rather not talk about because they were either pretty painful to me or they were involved in other situations, other startups where it was so obvious from the beginning that it was going to go wrong that you always feel sorry for them when it eventually does topple over. But so finding a good example you can talk about, because I can imagine with your, you know, many years of looking at this and actually relating this to students, you've already got some good examples packed away in your case study set.
So I don't want to talk about specifics. I'm going to talk more in generalities, but you'll get the gist. So there were times when I was at startup competitions and you could see that there was a lack of one aspect of understanding. And you could realize that from the way that people presented their product. You could realize that from the way that they presented the technology, or that they presented the marketing, or that they presented going to market strategy. And you could see that there was a naivete in one of those aspects. So because these people were at startup competitions, you could take them to the side and tell them, you know what? Yes, it was a good proposal. It was a nice presentation, but you're lacking in these areas and you need to find somebody who's going to provide knowledge in that specific area so that you create a more complete understanding of what you're trying to do. So sometimes people would listen, sometimes people wouldn't.
That's the thing about advice. You can give people all the best advice. They will always choose whether to take it or not. And that's absolutely fair. So yeah, I see that example, I guess, very similar to that, where I saw basically a couple of guys who were solving a problem that they themselves had. They'd actually discovered this problem at university. It looked like a really obvious thing they were trying to sort out. And they had solved it quite nicely. But what they hadn't considered was, well, just how many other people actually have the same problem? And it turned out that it was really niche. And yet they were pitching to sort of VCs who were thinking, well, where's your, you know, multi-million person sized market that this is worth pouring money into? It might have been a nice family business, but it probably wasn't a scaled business. And that was the mismatch in that scenario. And I can imagine that if you get the right balance of people, you can figure out how to broaden your approach to cover a larger number of people, or turn the business around and make it even more niche, but then whack up the price, for example. But it's that understanding of the different options you have that sometimes they just lack without that extra sort of...
Exactly. And you see that a lot with technical founders.
Right, okay.
Because they believe that what they're doing is going to save the world. Single-mindedness, focus, and this is what I want the product to be. And they don't realize the potential in other areas a lot of the time. So if you have a marketing person, if you have a person who comes from a different domain, and this is where domain knowledge comes, and it's very important to have an array of domains to pick from. So if you don't have those, that you see that there's that single-mindedness that leads to a very, very niche product that perhaps doesn't fit the market at all.
Yeah, as it was in the case that I was mentioning before. Or one that fits such a small slice of the market that it's not sustainable on its own. Yeah. And so, you know, so in terms of the kind of the things that don't work, while we're going through this sort of playbook of lessons to the early founder, technical founder, that is, I mean, we sort of mentioned domains there, but is there some areas where if you have literally got missing gaps or ignorance in certain areas that you, I mean, how would you go about sort of filling that out? I mean, the obvious one is to get advisors or to recruit somebody in. But are there any sort of non-obvious solutions that you've seen to that that's particularly effective?
I haven't seen non-obvious solutions, but here's an obvious one. Read a book, take a tutorial on something, particularly if you are more technical and you lack understanding of business in general, take a course in business strategy. There's a bunch of them online. Just so you understand what it means to actually run a company. This is why I like the a book called The E-Myth Revisited.
Yeah, very popular book.
I don't know if you've read it.
Yeah, we can definitely put a link to the notes. It's a very popular book for very sort of startup founders.
So it talks about exactly the person that does something, has a skill, and thinks that it's very easy to take that skill and turn it into a company that uses that skill. And it's not that easy. It's never that easy. And unfortunately, what ends up happening is most of the time, these people, because of their lack of understanding, they become slaves to their own companies. So instead of getting a company to do what you were supposed to getting away from, you do more of, plus a lot of other things. So if you're a technical founder and you're watching this episode, please get some business knowledge before you think about starting a business.
Yeah, but there's some really good books on strategy to read, actually. I think it's Alex Smith is another guy who's written a fairly good, easy, approachable book on business strategy. Just covers a whole lot of different strategies and sort of a bit of a teardown on the way some companies have worked. Like, how did Amazon get to where it is today with some fairly bold and unconventional choices? But ones that are totally unintuitive to the average sort of engineer-minded person, I think.
Yeah. And I'm going to say that, you know, a lot of people look up to Steve Jobs as a business acumen person. And I can't say anything bad about that, but he's not a very good example of a startup business founder. I would say don't do what he did, which is kind of the opposite of what a lot of people would say.
Yeah, the early stage of Apple, well, you'd say it either succeeded by accident or it didn't succeed because it kind of went through a pretty negative stage there.
Negative phase, exactly. And then they brought him back in and he turned it into the Apple that we know. But it wasn't until years later when he had a very different understanding of the game that he came in and turned things and could turn things around. So although, you know, the startup thing in the garage sounds wonderful.
It's actually better to study Next, isn't it? Where he went after, or in the gap in between, he came back Next. He did actually start from very early on and was successful at. But people rarely talk about Next because Next itself didn't actually succeed.
Exactly. And we have to admit it. There has to be some luck in this game. If you're a founder of any business, of any company, of any organization, you will need some luck.
Yeah, the odds are always against you.
Exactly.
Cool. So, and then when it comes to the things that are in your control, though, as a tech founder, clearly one of those things is the choice of actual technologies you decide to use. And that's probably something that you've seen a lot of.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, your role is to make those decisions, right? So in order to make those decisions, you can't just go by, oh, I know this. This is what I'm going to use. Oh, I like Linux. I love Linux. I'm going to be using Linux on my servers. I'm going to have co-located servers and I'm going to use Linux and I'm going to build this product and blah, blah, blah. It doesn't work that way. What we need to do is not just remain focused on the product and the way that we want to build it with the understanding that we have programming language. Nowadays, I love Golang. But if you ask me what I would use to build a telecommunication system, I would probably say C++, maybe even C. If you would ask me what I would use to write the backend for a bank, C again. Even though Golang is awesome and Rust, I love Rust, but I'm old fashioned. So you can't stay with just what you know. You need to go and look into things and say, okay, does this match what I want to do? Now, the other impediment here is that a lot of people will say, okay, you know, everybody's using this, so it should be good. So let's use that. All right, I'll go with that. But what if in your particular case, there's another tool, there's another language, there's another database, there's another model that you can use that is much better for that niche product that you're building.
But there are a specific use case you have.
Well, so in one company where I was CTO, I went in actually in order to bring technology development in-house. It was outsourced. And it was a mess. And the technologies that were decided were based on technologies that the outsourcing organization knew how to use in an extremely different niche than what we were in.
Sounds like a recipe for disaster already.
I don't want to go into a lot of details, but let's say that when I went in 1 year, removed all of the infrastructure, everything that was built in the way that it was built, and we replaced it with a very, very different infrastructure, different languages, different technologies, different stack that made sense for the niche that this company was in.
And I can imagine that was at quite some cost as well in that scenario.
So when I started talking about budgets and costs with the CEO of the company, he was taken aback because he felt that he had, you know, he had invested a lot of money in getting the company to where they were when I was called in. So I had to go through the whole business case explaining the problems with the current infrastructure and the pain points of the current infrastructure, and also the security problems. And because we were in a very specific niche that in which security is well regulated, it's not just required, he understood and he told me, okay, take the budget, use it, but please stay in budget.
Yep.
Now,
it's always a challenge.
So as you know, it's all about trade-offs, right? So stay in budget, stay on time. We managed to keep a balance. We were under budget, slightly over time, like about 7% over time. So
it's not too bad.
Yeah, it was. I think that was one of the more successful projects that I've had in terms of KPIs.
Yeah, that's really good. And I've often been brought in or asked to advise in similar situations where there's been early tech choices that have, in some cases, were made in sheer ignorance. Like I can choose anything because it's only the MVP. And of course, the MVP, the most temporary thing, ends up being the most permanent thing by the time everything is built on top of it. Or the situations where technical decisions were simply made in pure ignorance and often through no fault of the technical person, but because they either had to pivot a number of times and therefore ended up with very different assumptions or very different facts than there were original assumptions in the platform. Or some cases where somebody just doesn't know, you know, first-time founder doesn't have any comprehension of the implications of the choices they make and how far-reaching they become down the line. And then before you know, as you say, you end up with a sort of incompatible tech stack and problem space that is just something has to change. And a lot of the times, I think people underestimate the long-term cost of what might seem like an almost flippant choice in the early stages of a business.
Which is extremely important, right? Because once you lock on to a technology, then it's extremely different 2, 3, 4 years down the line where you actually hit your scale-up years. And if you're growing really fast and your tech stack can't support that growth, then you're dead in the water.
Or the flip side, even if your tech stack can handle it, but your recruitment targets can't handle it. If you can't find enough people with the skills or the skill combinations, which is normally the killer actually, that you specifically want or need because of what the choices you've made early on.
Exactly. So there's a plethora of things that can go wrong. And it's not that, you know, everybody gets everything right. No, but if you have a plan, and that's what I always say to any technical founder, any startup that I consult with, you do have plan A. I want you now to go back home and think about plan B, plan C, plan D, plan E, and if everything fails, plan F.
Plan F, F for fail.
Exactly.
I often see it as more like a tree though, because it's not sort of a linear drop down between A, B, C, and D. When you get to plan B, you then got, you know, sort of an A and B fallback. So it is like a sort of a binary tree that gets, you know, more and more complicated.
Exactly. The decisions become so complex. And at the bottom of the tree, you may have so many outcomes. And that's why you really want to, and we go into computer science terminology now, you really want to prune the branches so that your choices, your previous choices, will dictate your next choices, but they will dictate them in such a way that they guide you towards correct decisions.
Or at least leave more doors open than they close.
So sometimes, again, that's a problem, right? Because if you've got way more options than you thought, then what? Then you may get into an indecision loop, analysis paralysis. So that's why I'm always saying, look, you're going to make some decisions now that are going to affect your company for the foreseeable future. So try to foresee what you want, where you want to be, and then work backwards and say, okay, if I'm here in 10 years, and if I want to be supporting X, does my tech stack now support X? And most people will say, oh yeah, but you know, it's not really necessary to do that. You don't have to go with the big technology now. You can always scale up and so on and so forth. Yes, unfortunately, it becomes harder and harder to scale up the more you invest on the technology that will not scale up well. And we've seen that in legacy code bases.
Some of it comes down to the sunk cost fallacy, and some of it just comes down to the weight of existing capability that you don't want to throw away.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Take a look at British Airways and Air France and the supersonic jet that they had.
The Concorde.
Concorde, thank you. So Concorde was created. It became a bet for those two companies to complete it. It got completed, and then it was so expensive to use but they had already invested so much money in it that if they didn't use it, they were losing a lot of other stuff. Like they were losing branding. They were losing status. But eventually they realized that, you know, at some point you have to cut your losses. So they stopped using it.
They flew it for about 30 years though, didn't they?
They did. Always had loss, yeah.
Yeah, it was memorable. Good for branding, but not good for business.
Exactly. And it's one of those famous stories for the sunken cost fallacy. You know, like you invest a lot of time, money, effort in something that you realize in the process it's not going to work. But you've already invested so much. So you're saying, okay, we need to make this work. We need to make this work. And the more you do that, the more into that vicious circle you're falling.
And again, that's one of those ones where with, you know, a diversity of backgrounds, thoughts, patterns, experiences, you can get somebody, hopefully at some point it'll go, really? Do you actually have to, or do you just want to?
Exactly. And that's the key question, right? Do you have to, or do you want to?
Neither one of them are necessarily the right or wrong answer either, but it's choices have impact.
Exactly. It's having the choice doesn't mean that you have to do whatever you want. Do some things that you have to so that you can get to the things you want to when it's time to get to the things you want to. That sounds a lot like philosophizing, but...
Yeah. No, I like the way you put it before. Think about what happens if you actually get it right and you survive to the five-year point. One of the startups I worked for actually had a really great phrase. They painted on the wall after a while, actually. You know, a lot of startups think about, what happens if we fail? What happens if it goes wrong? And so they had painted on the wall, what happens if we succeed?
Exactly.
And it was that kind of phrase which people would come, and it was in the lobby, so you sort of see it every time you walk through. And being able to look at that and think, okay, actually, it was sort of a reminder that even though you're sort of trying to survive to the next 3 months, to the next funding round, though all those decisions are survival choices you make, if you succeed, those decisions are still going to persist, even though they were just to get you over the next 3 months.
Exactly. So I'm not saying that we're going to make the right choices all the time, but if you do have a plan and you look at it from a long-term perspective, where I want to be, coming backwards to where I am right now, that sometimes helps.
Yeah, that sounds an awful lot like the process of building a strategy, really, doesn't it? It's one of my hot topics, is making sure that you've got, number one, a vision. You know, what is it we're actually trying to do? And number two, how are we going to get there? Which is effectively the story of what we need to change to make that reality.
That's exactly right.
Cool. So we're trying to summarize your playbook that we come up with here then. So I think the number one thing that we talked about there was the lack of the understanding of the business impact of early tech choices, but choices in general rather than just the tech. So that was the sort of the first one. And the second one was, and actually this is the first thing we spoke about, was the challenges of when the tech founder gets overridden and how you sort of stand up for that one. And if you're having to stand up for it, the kind of the lesson is that you've probably missed an early stage of choosing a compatible co-founder.
And it's not only that, but it's also the fact that you probably shouldn't be there if you can't, I don't want to say enforce your opinion, but provide examples of why your opinion is the correct one or is the better one.
Yeah. And I think going closely onto that then is the next point, which is ignorance of the business side is just going to set you up for challenges and problems. So either, as you put it, read about it, learn about it, or hire for it, whether that's consultants or employees who can round out the knowledge, whether that's finance, marketing, business, sales, chain of value, et cetera.
Everything. Exactly. And there's a lot of talent out there. You know, just go find someone somehow that will give you what you lack.
Yeah. And then the last one we had, which we spoke about quite a lot, was the choice of this tech stack, especially not based on what I know or what I've worked with before, but more about those sort of long-term decisions.
Exactly. A tech stack for some people seems like a religion nowadays. And I don't like that. A tech stack is a tool. And yes, you're allowed to like more than one tech stack. You know, it's okay. Really.
You can like Linux and Mac.
Yeah, you could. Well, you know, Macs use Linux. So there you go. But yeah, it's okay to use different things for different products, for different methodologies, for different frameworks, for whatever. It's okay to not say, oh, this is my tech stack and I'm sticking to it. Well, sometimes, you know, it may be the wrong one.
Or you may need a multiple tech stack in order to actually solve the solution you have at hand.
Yeah.
Some of the most interesting startups I know have actually ended up having to build two relatively parallel tech stacks just because of the business case they had involved two very different domains, and the value of the business was in bringing those two domains together. And therefore, it just needed two competing tech stacks.
Exactly. You basically see it all the time. If I'm a B2C and then I want to go into B2B, sometimes my B2C stack doesn't really work for B2B. So I do need to choose something else. And you see it in a lot of companies that they have two different types of teams working on two different tech stacks altogether.
And yeah, and it can be very strong, especially when you're able to recruit for both and find good talent in the market. Yeah.
And there's a lot of good talent in the market right now.
It's a good time to be hiring, not necessarily a good time to be a person needing to be hired right now.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Let's hope 2025 brings a slightly more balanced view to the market. I think.
Here's hoping.
I mean, it's a very interesting perspective of the market at the moment because it's different than it's been in sort of, I don't know, 20, 25, maybe even 30 years, where the sort of the ratio of available people to the amount of roles has flipped about 18 months ago. And there's it's literally a first in industry and probably in most people's working lifetime.
Yeah. What can you do?
Yeah. Hey, on that note, you probably talk to early founders all the time, but if you have one overriding piece of advice that you would give to an early tech founder, what would that be?
Learn the business side of things.
Very emphatic, very simple, very straightforward. Learn the business.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually echoed by quite a few of the CTOs that I bring onto the CTO playbook. So there you go. It's getting reinforced more and more. Learn the business, tech folk. It's where the power is.
Yeah, because, and let's end with that, a CTO is not a tech person. C-suite is a business strategy.
Business role first. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. It's your new domain when you step up into the C-suite.
Exactly.
So learn it. Yeah. Cool. Yorgos, it's been absolutely fantastic to have you on. Thank you very much. If people want to get in touch with you and get, how do people reach you?
LinkedIn. They can find me on LinkedIn. Georgios Christou. I do have that PhD in the end.
We'll put a link in the notes so people can find it nice and easily.
Awesome.
Thank you very much. It's been fantastic to speak to you. Thanks for your time.
It was awesome being here. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for listening all the way through to the end. Just before you go, I'd like to ask you for one thing in return for putting together all these episodes of the CTO Playbook podcast for you. Please leave a review. Wherever you're listening, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whichever platform you're on, leaving a quick review will help more CTOs find the podcast and enable me to create more great episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the CTO Playbook.